All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It is Thursday afternoon, 12:40, April 29th. And today, what we have up is conjugated systems. So this morning, what I did is use a little bit of lab time to go over more of the electrophilic aromatic substitution reactions and do a bunch of examples, basically a problem-solving session. And I'll do the same thing this afternoon. So we'll go over the similar problems this afternoon in that. So that was a good session. And that kind of takes us to where we want to be. Looking through the textbook, I see that in this version of Klein also put in nucleophilic substitution reactions within the aromatic scheme. And I'm just going to go over and skip those. So we'll pass those up because I want to get really into more of the carbonyl chemistry. The carbonyl chemistry is more important, covers more of the biological reactions rather than trying to go through nucleophilic aromatic substitution. And the nucleophilic aromatic substitution is very similar to the electrophilic. It's just that you have a nucleophile coming in and attacking an aromatic group with an electron withdrawing group on it. And it goes through a similarly charged species called a Meisenheimer complex, which is negatively charged instead of positively charged. It's very similar chemistry, and many of the textbooks skip it altogether and really just show the electrophilic rather than the nucleophilic. So we're going to skip that, and we'll go ahead and we'll do just the electrophilic component. Okay, so what I want to get into then is backtracking, because what I also noticed is that I skipped around in the chapters. In this version of Klein, they also moved the chapters around. So it used to be that the aromatic chemistry was right after the spectroscopy. And it looks like what they did is they put the conjugated systems right after the spectroscopy. And then they put the aromatic following that. So what we're going into is actually backtracking into chapter 16. So this is now chapter 16 in Klein.
You're not screen sharing yet.
Well, you know, make it up as we go along. I suppose that's important. Thank you, BB. Okay, so chapter 16 in Klein. Well, let's say this. Let me go ahead and outline what happens. Chapter 16 in Klein was or is conjugated systems. In the conjugated systems, it doesn't like systems. There we go. In the conjugated systems, they look at conjugate addition. They look at Diels-Alder. And they look at paracyclic reactions. Then in chapter 17 was aromaticity. And chapter 18 is electrophilic and nucleophilic. Aromatic substitution. So this we've already covered. Then when you get into chapter 19, this is where we get into aldehydes and ketones. So,
hey Jason, it froze.
Yeah, it's been doing this. It was doing this morning too. Hopefully, it won't do it a ton. It usually, like about a minute in for some reason freezes, then it's stable for a good while. And then towards the end, it'll start freezing up again. We'll see what happens. So we did chapter 17 and 18, except we're leaving out the nucleophilic aromatic substitution. So we're going to skip this part here. We're going to go back and we're going to pick up now chapter 16 with the conjugated additions. And then from chapter 16, we'll leapfrog from 16 back to 19, and we'll pick up with the aldehydes and ketones. And that's where I really want to get to, is in the aldehyde and ketone chemistry and with the enols and the enolates and all of this chemistry, which is more along the lines of the biologically oriented chemistry. And it also just gives us a lot, there's a lot really good, interesting chemistry that happens in here that will take us towards carbohydrates and other systems. So we'll see how far we can get after we get into chapter 19. Okay, so for today, we're gonna pick up in chapter 16 in Klein. Okay, so the other thing that I don't have up, is I don't have the chat up, because Kelly was telling me that it froze too. Now I can see the chat and where we're going. Okay. So let's pick up with this with conjugated systems. Some of this within the conjugated systems is already review. And actually, I don't need to move that. I can just leave that there. When we start looking at conjugated systems. Where do I really want to start this? One of the easiest places to start looking at things is, first off, just a definition that if we look at a system that has a double bond in it, the position that is the carbon that is shown explicitly here, this is the allylic carbon. And these hydrogens here are allylic hydrogens. The hydrogen that is here is vinylic. So allylic, we oftentimes just call it the allylic position. Vinylic or vinyl is how we refer to the hydrogen that's there. So we have the allylic position and the vinylic position. So when we start to then take and look at some of these conjugated systems, we can look at, of course, allylic cations. Or you can have an allylic anion. Or you can have an allylic radical. And all of these are conjugated. We'll spend more time looking at the cations and the radicals than we will looking at the others. But let's just take the allylic cation for a second. And of course, we know that there is resonance with this, that we can draw the resonance that is associated with that allylic cation. But when we look at that, what does that actually mean? And what is it look like and represent in terms of the molecule? Now, what we can draw or sometimes draw is to say that we put a dotted line here and that we have partial positive and partial positive out at the two positions. Or sometimes what they'll say is they'll draw it this way. They'll take Maybe I should have just copied that. And they'll put the positive charge just in the center, where the dotted line represents the movement of that positive charge across it. And so these are different representations for the system, because when we look at that system, what we actually see is that that system has a series of orbitals, and it acts as a single pi system where these are fully conjugated throughout the pi system. And so the positive charge that resides in that doesn't reside in one place or the other place. It resides in both places simultaneously. And we can actually bring up the orbitals that are in that system, that comprise that system, where there's the two electrons sitting in this system. We have both the bonding orbital, which covers and looks like an extended pi orbital, both top and bottom. And then we have the antibonding, where the antibonding has the system empty, and the antibonding really is what is thought of as that positive charge, the existence of, or the absence of the electrons in that positive charge. So let me see if I can pull that up. I have a note to myself that I have an image in WebMO. And I didn't think to grab it to look at where that is, but let me see if I can find it real quick for you. So let me stop the share. And
Jason, I kind of had a question about that, because that's what I spent a lot of yesterday doing, was playing around, like looking at the orbitals on WebMO. Uh-huh. And they give you like 20 of them. So how do you know, like, which, what, like, how do you even, I don't know. I just looked at it and I was like, this is crazy. But I was able to figure out some of them were bonding and some of them weren't.
Yeah, I'll show you exactly how to find them on WebMO. I'm glad you got in. So the password that we reset worked okay and everything's good.
Yeah, it worked perfectly.
Good. Okay, so I think I need to go to, this is where you would go to normally log in. It's just hitting the Cabrillo server. But I have an implementation of this that is my research server. And I think this is where I've got the orbitals. Below the cations. And let's try this guy. Actually, that didn't show me as having, this is the molecular orbital one. Okay, so here what I've got is I've got an allylic cation. We can see that carbon number 2 is sp2 hybridized. It's flat, planar, coplanar with the sp2 hybridized alkene that is here. And then carbon number 1 is sp3 hybridized. So carbon number 1 is not in that system, but I just to do an extended sort of system to be able to see it. Now, as to the nature of the orbitals, Stirling said that there was like 20 of them. There's actually way more than 20 of them. There's actually 74 of them. So if I extend this out, I'm just showing 18 of 74, but I can request it to show me all 74. And it will indeed take me all the way down through 74 orbitals. So why are there 74 orbitals? First of all, because when you look at the number of electrons that are in the system, what the system does is it takes all the electrons for each one of these guys and every atomic orbital that is going into this, and it blends all of those atomic orbitals to make molecular orbitals. So for every atomic orbital going into it, there is an equal number of molecular orbitals coming out. So if I take, you know, the 1s orbital for each of the hydrogens, but then I have the 1s, the 2s, the 2px, 2py, 2pz for each carbon, and I put all those together and combine all of those, then I end up with 74 orbitals. Now, how do I know which are occupied and which are not? The occupancy, which is listed here, is telling me there are 2 electrons in each one of these orbitals. And when I get to the point where there are no longer any electrons, when I hit zero, this orbital here, number 15, that orbital is the highest occupied molecular orbital, and orbital 16 is the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. So all of those that are zero are unoccupied, and they are increasing in energy. So you can see that I'm transitioning from negative energies to positive energies, and that those energies continue to increase. So I'm starting at the core orbitals that are here and extending out to the valence orbitals, and then eventually into the antibonding empty orbitals. So that's how I would read that. And the orbital that I really want to be concerned with is I want to look at 17, I think. Not 17, I really want to look at, there's a lot of hard trees, yeah. I really want to look at, I believe, orbital 15. Let's see what that one looks like. There it is. So you can see that orbital 15, this is the highest occupied molecular orbital. And this orbital looks very much like a pi bond. And it is a pi bond of sorts, because that orbital combines all the way over to include the p orbital nature of carbon number two. And you can see that there is much more density over three and four, that three and four, the lobe is bigger over three and four, and see how it tanks and declines as it goes over orbital number two. Then when we look at the antibonding, so we'll catch the lowest unoccupied, the LUMO, lowest unoccupied molecular orbital, orbital 16. We catch that one. Here you can see the nature of that P orbital and how that P orbital is empty. But, you know, there's other parts to this that look like P orbitals as well. And that's true because it's not natural bonding orbitals. It is not a localized orbital. This is molecular orbital theory. Molecular orbital theory uses delocalized orbitals over the entire molecule. So this is truly the carbocation, which is here on two, but part of that empty orbital extends over the hydrogens on the methyl group and over the carbon, which is carbon number four. And we expect carbon number four, right? Because of the resonance. So because of the resonance, we expect to see partial charge on two and partial charge on four. And these are the empty orbitals that reside on four and two that give you that partial positive charge. So that's where that partial positive charge is coming from. We can also see that if we go back and we reset the viewer and we ask the viewer to show us the partial positives and negatives. So these are the partial charges here, and we can view those. And we can see that carbon here, which was carbon number two, and carbon number four, carbon two bears the majority of the partial positive charge because this is a static image. But also carbon number four here is less negative than the carbon number three, which is just indicating that there is some distribution there of that charge. And they're not nearly as negative as the methyl group that's out here that isn't part of that conjugated system. So, okay. Does that help, Sterling, with a little bit with the bonding and antibonding, what orbitals to focus on?
Yeah, that was cool. So when you look at the LUMO, it's basically like giving you a picture of where the charge imbalance is.
Yes. There's another location that we can see that. So the LUMO helps to show that. I don't know if, yes, this should show me here too. It gives me an electron density, electrostatic potential, the electrophilic, the HOMO frontier density, and the nucleophilic LUMO frontier density. These are sort of aggregates of all of the orbitals that help to show you where the nucleophilic sites and the electrophilic sites are. So if I want to know where the nucleophilic sites are, this molecule are, where the partial positives are, then I want to look at this LUMO frontier density. It takes a second to calculate it. And where the blue area is, that's where your partial positives are within the molecule. And so you can see that really, correspondingly, there's very little out here. There's almost nothing. But really, it's in carbon number two and in carbon number four that those are where your partial positives reside.
That's cool.
So that's another place to look to be able to see that. Okay. I think that's all I need to show you there. Let me go ahead, stop that share, unless there's any other questions.
Let me bring it back. I had a question about like vanillic carbocations, because when we were doing acid catalyzed hydration of an alkyne, and we were determining like whether or not the, like which carbon would end up being positive and which carbocation intermediate would form.
Yeah.
Sometimes there was one where it would have a conjugated system stepping towards one carbon, but if you step towards the other carbon with the partial positive or with the positive charge, it would have a resonance with like a benzylic ring or something. And I was just kind of confused about, I guess, the resonance in a vanillic carbocation.
So in a vanillic carbocation, what you're looking at is you're looking at a carbocation that resides in this position. Maybe we could do it that way. That this would be a vanillic carbocation, and that the orbital that the vanillic carbocation resides within is not in the same plane as the pi bond. So if we take this and we think of this bond as being flat, so that these hydrogens are coming out towards us, the R group is going back away. This lone pair goes back away, and the pi bond resides in this plane where this is 90 degrees to the plane in which the electrons in a vinylic, well, there's no electrons in there, but where the empty orbital is for the vinylic cation. Because that vinylic cation resides in an sp2 hybrid and is fundamentally different than the allylic cation, which is a true p orbital. So when we're looking at the difference between that guy, maybe I should leave that there for a second, and this guy, the difference is that the positive charge, the positive charge resides in this location. This is the allylic cation. And it allows for the resonance here within that system, because they're all coplanar for the orbitals. Cannot spell today. And the vinylic one is just in a different location. So when we were looking at the reaction that you're talking about, we had some R group and we had the triple bond, and we were looking at protonating this and saying that there were two different sides to which it could protonate. We could protonate on this side, creating the positive charge that would exist. Actually, it wouldn't even, well, that's not even fair. I take that back. It's not as I specified. I was thinking that I wouldn't have a substituent there, but I do. Let me take this back. Let me redraw this and think this through again. When you look at a triple bond, the way that a triple bond works is that you have one set of orbitals which are in one plane, and 90 degrees to that, you have the other set of orbitals. And when you have that vinylic cation I think that it's more appropriate actually to look at that system as being, here is one of the pi system.
Okay, that's why I was so confused. It's because the first thing you'd said made sense with everything we've learned, where, right, you know, coplanar, or not coplanar, but like, you know, in the SB2 hybrid. But what we're saying is that it actually conjugates and it looks more like a diradical.
Well, no, it's not going to conjugate and look like a diradical. I was trying to get to how this was going to, let's take it this way, bring in the proton, bring in the R group. And then this carbon is sp2 hybridized. You have the p orbital, which is part of the pi system, but then we have an orbital which extends out this way and back that way, and that would be the positive charge. And it is 90 degrees. It's still 90 degrees to the system. It's still not conjugated. It's still not like a diradical, but it doesn't allow for conjugation of this positive charge with the pi system that's here. It allows for conjugation of this positive charge with other things. If there was something other than an H here that had pi orbitals, that would allow it to look like an alenic system. So I think that what we're trying to convey here, let me get rid of this guy and show you an alenic system. In the alenic system, what you have is you have R and R like this. So this is an alenic system. And the pi system in an alenic system has one set of orbitals this side that are up and down. And on this side, they come out and go back. Out and forward. And so this one comes forward and back, and they are 90 degrees to one another. Not the best drawing, but that's more along the lines of what happens with this positive charge that is the vinylic positive charge and where that sits. So there's the possibility that it could be as I was originally drawing, but as I think about it more, I think that those systems generally are SP hybridized and are linear, where the proton sits linear with the two carbons. And that means that this one comes out of the plane and back in the plane, 90 degrees to the existing pi system that's there. And these orbitals here are occupied orbitals. In their location and existence, and the other orbital is an unoccupied orbital. That sits in there. And so if we go and we build that and we look at it, I'm sure that we'll see that the LUMO sits and sits in the same plane with the hydrogen and the R group that sits back there. It doesn't explain the resonance per se, and I don't know that I fully understood or where your question was going before, but what it does say is that you're not going to have back resonance with this orbital back to these two. You could have resonance going forward with whatever group happens to be here, much in the same way that an alenic system does. That if we think about this system as being the pi system, and then this being maybe the cation and something that can donate to it, we can get very much an alenic system. And I think that for many of those systems, when I did draw resonance, I drew it as an alenic system. I just don't think that we talked about what happens to these R groups in their orientation to each other and how they're 90 degrees to each other. So I think that's where a lot of that goes.
Thank you for addressing that.
It's worth taking time on, because this chapter is all about orbitals and being able to visualize the orbitals. And so I don't feel like this was an aside that took us 10 minutes out of the way. Talking about the location of orbitals and thinking about the orbitals is actually really important, because that's what this chapter is all about, is understanding the location of orbitals and what's happening with them, particularly when we get to the Diels-Alder reaction and the paracyclic reactions. So this is good, okay? All right, so as we're talking about those, let's look at how those orbitals play into some chemical reactions. Let's look at a couple sulvolysis reactions. So in sulvolysis reactions, you know, these are SN1 reactions. And I want to look at two in particular SN1 reactions. I want to look at this one with ethanol and heat that makes this species. And I want to look at this one. Similar reactions. And I want to say which one, or ask which one goes first, faster.
The bottom one, maybe?
Why?
Because it can go through the rate determining step of forming the tertiary carbocation faster.
Okay. So the idea here is that this guy could pop off, and if it pops off, it gives me the tertiary carbocation. And then I have the ethanol that comes in the next step, and that binds to it. And then there's a couple more steps that need to happen. There's a deprotonation that takes me to that species, right? Okay, and then this guy could also pop off. And when it does, it gives me this species. And same sort of thing. The ethanol then can come in, bind to it, and several more steps. Following a deprotonation, I can get to that species there. Does everyone agree that the bottom one goes faster because it goes through a tertiary carbocation?
No, the top one's allylic.
Top one's allylic. So what does it mean to be allylic rather than tertiary carbocation? What does the top one have that the bottom one doesn't?
Resonance instead of induction.
Resonance instead of induction. This is true. Okay, so relative rates. K relative. This is K equals 100. This is K equals 1. But the top reaction is 100 times faster than the bottom reaction due to resonance. So always got to keep an eye out for resonance. Remember that we've said here that resonance is always a stronger force than induction. So good to remember that component. It's easy to go for the carbocation, and that we get trained to go for the carbocation, and that's true. And so there's nothing wrong with that answer in saying, yes, carbocations, tertiary carbocations are extremely stable due to their induction and the electron donation that we get from three different carbons to that carbocation. However, resonance is always a more stabilizing force, and we need to keep our eye out for that resonance and where that resonance happens. Okay, let's take another reaction. Let's look at this reaction. Same reaction we were just looking at, or very similar. I want to look at the chloride now reacting with water instead of ethanol, and we'll use a base. We'll use sodium carbonate to help this reaction go. And when this reaction proceeds, what's my main product? What do I expect to be my main product? I expect an alcohol, but let me go ahead and label 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, maybe label that guy 5. Where does the alcohol wind up? We don't know. There's a question.
Possibly three. I want to say two, but I want to say maybe that can be a hydride. No, hydride shift. No.
Those are good thoughts. I mean, hydride shifts are definitely something to look for when we have carbocations. But let's take it again and look at that and think about the resonance associated with it. That the resonance is going to place the positive charge out on carbon number one.
And so does this get to like the back to thermodynamic?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Kinetic versus thermodynamic. That is exactly what we're saying here, is that this gets back to kinetic versus thermodynamic. And that what we're looking at here is that with these two, when we look at it in aggregate, what we see is that we have an allylic carbocation, but we have a large partial positive at the tertiary position and a smaller partial positive at the primary position. And we end up with two different products. And the product ratio is somewhat going to be dependent upon the nature of the reaction conditions, the temperature of the conditions. Let's say that this is run at room temp, 25 degrees Celsius, and which is fairly cold. What we would see in this case is a combination of two products. And I have them listed out at 85% and 15% for this reaction, for the way this reaction is running. Let me give you another reaction. I want to make it so you can see both. What are my products for the second reaction going to be?
Would it be the same?
Yes, it would.
Because there's resonance stabilization?
Yeah. It is exactly the same products, because it goes through the same carbocation. It doesn't matter where the chloride leaves from. It doesn't matter if the chloride leaves from carbon number one or leaves from carbon number three. The same carbocation is created, and that carbocation is not two different species. It is one species. And so that carbocation is identical, and the products, therefore, are identical. And so this goes through the same carbocation. And because of that, same products. So the carbocation is not any different. Which is actually pretty nice to see, because we think, you know, if you start off with the leaving group coming off on a different position, that maybe the developing carbocation develops on one and it takes time for the resonance to occur, which is not true. The resonance is instantaneous. The resonance is not a flipping back and forth of species. And I think this reaction, more than anything, highlights the fact that the carbocation is the same carbocation regardless of where the leaving group leaves from, and that there is only one carbocation. There may be two resonance contributors that tell us about the nature of that carbocation, but there is only one carbocation. So that's important. Also important along these lines, as we're dealing with these things, is that the radical stability mirrors carbocation stability. And so while we've been talking about carbocations, free radicals fall under this same reaction style. So let's say here, remember that free radical stability closely follows carbocation stability. So when we look at an allylic radical, an allylic radical is very much like an allylic carbocation. And we have the same sort of nature to this, where we have a single species with partial radical on each one of the carbons distributed over it. And so this is where we get other reactions that we have already studied, where we can take and do Cl2 and light and go through the free radical reaction, whereby we chlorinate at the allylic position. Or a better way to do this would have been maybe not with the chlorine, but we could have used N-bromosuccinamide or N-chlorosuccinamide. I'll use NCS. I'll draw a picture of what that is in just a second. A little bit of heat and light. And this would likewise go through and chlorinate in the allylic position. So NBS was for brominations. And had the bromine in that position, and bromosuccinamide. NCS is N-chlorosuccinamide. Same thing, just with the chlorine. Allows us to do either brominations or chlorinations under free radical conditions. All right, so when we start to talk about dienes then, and we start to look at truly conjugated systems, not just charged conjugated systems or radical conjugated systems, but looking at full conjugated systems. One of the things that we know that maybe I haven't fully spelled out here, let's talk about dienes for a minute, is that there are different types of dienes. First, we can have isolated. An isolated diene is where you have an sp3 hybridized carbon in the center. We can have conjugated, which is where they're all sp2. And then we can have cumulated, which is the way that we refer to a system that is an allenic system. So these are allenes. S on the E on the end of that. E-N-E-S. Or an allenic system. So those are the ways that we refer to different types of dienes: isolated, conjugated, and cumulated. And it turns out that when we look at the conjugated systems are more stable than the isolated systems. I think I showed this to you before when we were talking about aromaticity, and I did it without actual numbers. In this one, I think I actually have the numbers that we can take a look at a isolated system, and the conjugated system. And we can hydrogenate these and take them both down to the same hydrogenated level, so that what we're doing is we're taking these down to 2, 3, 4, 5. So this would be a pentane. And we're looking at taking and adding hydrogen to it with platinum. And what we find is that we release, I think it's 252 kilojoules per mole. So this turns out to be 252 kilojoules per mole that comes out of the system. And at the halfway point, you could say that halfway point, you're sort of just hydrogenated one of them, and it's 126 kilojoules for one and 126 kilojoules for the other. And so it's just twice the amount of energy coming out, one for each of the double bonds. When we look at this system over here, this system is actually more stable, and a lot less energy comes out when we hydrogenate it. So hydrogenating this down to the same point, we get 226 kilojoules. And what we find is that when you hydrogenate the first double bond, that the first double bond is 111 kilojoules of energy that comes out, and then 115 for the second part. But overall, it's 15 kilojoules per mole more stable. And that is the stability of conjugation. It's just how much more stable that bond is because of the conjugation. Okay, so what other factors does this conjugation do then? When we look at the isolated system, one of the things that you should recognize about the isolated system is that the isolated system has free rotation about the sigma bonds. And so I can look at this system as having free rotation, and I can draw different conformations, and that there is some energy barrier to rotation, but that energy barrier is strictly the energy difference in the Newman projections that I can draw, and the sterics of having to go past the eclipsed conformation into the next staggered conformation. And so if I were to view this sort of down the sigma bond, what I would see is that, let's assume that it is flat to begin with, as I look at it that way. And then these bonds out here, two of them would be hydrogens, and one of them would be the remaining double bond that would be around that, and that I have free rotation about this, and that I'm going to get energy barriers that are going to happen as these two hydrogens go eclipsed as it tries to rotate. So there is some small energy barrier due to sterics. But at room temperature, there's enough energy there for that system to freely rotate. When I look at this system, and I wish I had numbers to put to the first one. I don't have good numbers to put to the first one. When we look at this system and this sigma bond, we should have free rotation about this sigma bond as well, right? I mean, it's just a sigma bond. This thing should be able to rotate. And I should be able to rotate the system this way. However, this one actually has a very large barrier of rotation. So this guy up above, let's see if I can demonstrate that if I want to look at this guy rotating, that it's going to have ups and downs in terms of its energy. So this would be a dihedral angle. And this is going to be energy. And what we would do is, and for the barrier of rotation of looking at how much energy it takes to rotate this from one to the other, we would be going from this energy to this energy. And this is your activation energy here that is the barrier to rotation from one conformation to the next. This guy has a much higher energy barrier for rotation than the isolated system. Why would this have a higher energy barrier for rotation?
Because that would break the sp2 and it wants to stay flat.
It's true. Okay, so it's not, you're right on the mark, but the words could be cleaned up a little bit. So much higher barrier to rotation. What happens is in this system, you don't break sp2. The sp2 never changes. All of the carbons stay sp2. So all the way through, whether I'm looking at this system as a sort of a linear system or as a bent system, all carbons in this are sp2 all the time. What I break is I break conjugation. So when I'm looking at it here, the system is fully conjugated. And here it's fully conjugated. That's not a good picture. The problem is with this one to try to draw out that last orbital, both fully conjugated, but in the rotation, when I go to rotate it, what has to happen is one system breaks conjugation from the other. And it momentarily goes to a isolated system. What that means is you go through that isolated system as you break the conjugation. That 100 or that 15 kilojoules per mole that is the stability of conjugation, that's the energy barrier that you basically have to break in order to rotate these. Is you got to go, it's not quite 15, it's actually about 12, but it's a substantial amount of energy that is required to break the conjugation, to break the molecular orbital in order to allow this thing to rotate. So you're actually changing it in the process of going through and rotating it. This is a pseudo trans conformation, and this one a pseudo cis conformation in the way that we would think about a trans double bond and a cis double bond. Even though that's not really what we're talking about here, that's why we use the word pseudo in front of it, because it's these conformations have a pretty serious barrier to rotation. And I don't have enough room there to draw it, so I'll draw it down here. What we see is that when we look at these systems, come on, click in. There we go. That the systems
Hey, Jason.
Did it freeze?
Yeah.
Thanks. Appreciate that. Fortunately, you guys pick up pretty quickly when it freezes. I'm not watching it. I'm watching what I'm drawing. So I don't actually see it when it freezes. So that's really helpful when you guys call it out. The energy of activation here is about 12 kilojoules per mole, which is not a small number. That's a pretty big number, a pretty big barrier to rotation because you're breaking conjugation in order to be able to do that.
Jason, I had a question about that.
And it's actually more than I thought. I just drew it the wrong way, but go ahead. Give me the question and then I'll fix it.
So when it's rotating from the pseudo trans to pseudo cis, energy of activation is 12 kilojoules per mole. But when it rotating from the pseudo cis to the pseudo trans, would it be slightly less energy? Because isn't there a flagpole interaction between the hydrogens in the pseudo cis? And that would make it higher energy?
Let me do it this way. First off, I did have my barrier of activation energy correct here, but I think that what I want to do, I have it listed as 12 kilojoules per mole difference in energy between the two, so that this energy difference here, I have this listed as 12 kilojoules per mole, and I have this energy through the transition state, which takes you through the twisted. That twisted is taking me at 16 kilojoules per mole. In terms of that. And so this guy is more stable by 12 kilojoules per mole than the pseudo cis conformation. So the pseudo trans conformation, 12 kilojoules per mole more than the pseudo cis. Now the flagpole orientation, what, tell me more, what were you trying to ask, Sterling?
No, I think that answers it. It's just because the hydrogens are like hitting each other in the pseudo cis, and that's why it's higher. 12 kilojoules per mole higher than the pseudo trans.
That's exactly right, because you're looking at these two hydrogens that come off of this, and the two hydrogens are essentially conflicting. There is a steric interaction between the two hydrogens where these guys are bumping into each other, and that's where your increased energy is coming from and why this is higher in energy.
So is, I mean, to utilize my basic math skills, is the whole activation energy like 28,
yes,
right? Okay, good.
Yeah. With your basic math skills, yes. So your barrier to rotation is more like 28 as opposed to the other. It was what I was looking at as I was going back is I was picking out the difference in energy between the pseudocis and the pseudotrans. And I was looking at this number erroneously a little bit in that when we hydrogenate one of these, now don't even get into it. Just follow what I said here. I had confused myself based on the other information I had, but this is what it is. 16 kilojoules per mole plus 12. So that's your 28 kilojoules per mole barrier for rotation going one direction, but only 16 kilojoules per mole barrier rotation for going the other direction. So it depends on which direction we're going as to what our barrier to rotation is. Okay. All right, new reaction. Let's take a diene system, something that we can tell the difference in. So we'll go to a cyclic molecule. So this is 1,3 cyclopentadiene. And what I want to do is I want to treat this with HCl. And I want to know what my product is. So remember this reaction where the hydrogen adds first, chlorine adds second.
Hydrohalogenation.
It's hydrohalogenation. So what I'm going to get is I'm going to get the hydrogen adding and the chlorine adding. That's one product. But I also get another product. I can get the hydrogen adding and the chlorine adding in that position. So how is this taking place? All right, so the first step is where the double bond picks up the proton. When it picks up the proton, we go to the allylic carbocation. The allylic carbocation then is a combination of resonance contributors. And the chloride that's coming in can either attack this position or this position. So we have to have a way to refer to these so that this system here, this system is called the 1-2 addition. So if we think about the first step as adding at carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, there's your 1-2 addition where the hydrogen is added on carbon 1 and the chlorine is added on number 2. The second one is called 1-4 addition. Sometimes this is also called conjugate addition. And the other one called direct addition. Which one is major is determined by the reaction conditions to some degree. So in this one, it's difficult to explain which one would be major. And it would depend upon how much time is allowed for the chlorine to attack. So that if we imagine that in this system, if we think about the chlorine being present and close to the hydrogen, when the bond first attacks, this position here, the direct position, the 1-2 addition position, is in close proximity to the chlorine, allowing the chlorine to attack that position very quickly. But if the solvent conditions are such that the ions are heavily solvated and there is time before the chloride is allowed to attack, time for the chlorine to migrate to the 1-4 position, then the 1-4 position can become major. And it's a question of what are the reaction conditions. More so for this one, because it's symmetrical. When we get to an unsymmetrical one, then we get even more interesting questions. So in an unsymmetrical one, it really comes down to conditions. And I wanted to see if I had data. Everything is kinetic versus thermodynamic, but I don't have actual temperatures to give you and numbers to give you with the temperature. So let's do it this way. Let's look at an unsymmetrical system where I could get 1, 2, and 1, 4. We'll add HCl across it, and we'll do it at, well, I guess I do have numbers. We'll do it at minus 80 degrees Celsius, minus 78. I don't like minus 80. Why don't I like minus 80? Because some textbook rounded off minus 80 from minus 78. Minus 78 is the temperature that you get when you mix dry ice and acetone, and it is a standard cooling temperature. There is no solution that I know of that you combine that you get minus 80. And so minus 78 is the actual temperature that's achieved in many of these reactions. In this case, under these very cold conditions, I have the possibility of doing the direct addition and doing the conjugate addition. And so this one being the 1, 2, or direct, versus the 1, 4. This one being direct, this one being conjugate. Any idea which one is the major under these reaction conditions? It's really, really cold.
The 1, 4.
Why would the 1, 4 be major?
Well, if it has to do with the amount of time that it needs to do 1, 4, then slowing it down would do that.
Ah, but you've made it colder. And think about what happens with molecular motion. So with molecular motion, there's very little energy for things to move at this point. So there's not a lot of movement. This sort of traps the chloride very close to the developing carbocation and actually tends to lead to the 1-2 addition as opposed to the 1-4. So what we see in this case is we see about 80% is direct addition and about 20% is the conjugate addition. These are also another way to term these, and I think it was Stirling who said it earlier, is that this one is the kinetic product and the other one the thermodynamic. Now, how am I pulling that out? Well, look at the number of times that the double bond is substituted. This one, the double bond is mono-substituted. So I think what I really want to highlight is the substituent on the double bond to say that this is mono-substituted. And the other one has two substituents and is disubstituted. So the disubstituted is the more stable of the double bonds. And yet the monosubstituted is the one that forms fastest because that's the direct addition, the 1-2 addition. So this is a kinetic versus thermodynamic. And remember what conditions are supported, or what conditions support the kinetic product. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. The kinetic product is supported by cold reaction temps and short reaction times. The thermodynamic is supported by hot reaction temperatures or high temp and longer reaction times. So if I change this reaction, I can change the ratios. I can take this reaction and do the same reaction at room temperature. And at room temperature, what I'll see is a change in my products that direct versus conjugate that I'm now getting about, what is it, 44% direct and 56% conjugate. So the conjugate has become major at room temperature. Increase this temperature even more, and we can shift this even more. We can shift it even more dramatically. And what the higher temperature is doing is the higher temperature is just giving the chlorine more energy to shift. But in addition, it's doing this. If we look at these reactions, the reactions are going through the carbocation and then through So the carbocation is here. This is the allylic carbocation. Come on. And then one of them is lower than the other one. I don't know why it has such a hard time snapping in sometimes. It just doesn't want to do it. There we go. Okay. So I think what I'm trying to show with this is that this one would be the 1,4 addition versus the 1,2 addition. This is your initial activation energy. But kinetic versus thermodynamic is really decided over on this side of the reaction, which is really not our rate determining step, but is determining versus going 1,2 versus 1,4. This reaction is less reversible. This one is more reversible. This one is higher in energy. Because what has to happen here is you're attacking the smaller partial positive, and you need time for migration. This one here, lower energy, you're attacking the larger partial positive, and less time for attack. Doesn't need migration. So that's where we get into the kinetic versus thermodynamic. Okay, is that all making sense and gelling? Sort of a rehash of what we've done before. This also comes into play in reactions, not just with like acid and HBr, but or HCl, but we can also see this come into play in things like bromination. That Br2 with CCl4, we can see that we can get two different products that would come out of this guy. A bromination where we get a direct addition, and a bromination where we get a conjugate addition. But I guess the question here is, what was the mechanism of brumination? You guys remember? It was an anti-addition. Remember that it anti-added to a double bond? And so if it anti-adds to a double bond, then what's going to happen is I had a tack here and here, and I kicked out the bromide. This takes me to, initially, the cyclic bromonium ion that was positively charged. That means that in order to get the direct addition over here, what I need to do is I need to have a Br minus come in and attack either that position. That would lead me to the 1-2 addition. Or alternatively, that partial positive that's on the bromide also bears out on the terminal end of that alkene, and the Br minus can attack here, flipping the electrons over to give you the 1-4 addition. And the same rules apply in terms of looking at major and minor. Okay, so all the reactions that we did when we did electrophilic additions to double bonds, to alkenes, we could go back and we could revisit in terms of the dienes, and we'll see that we can get this 1-2 versus 1-4 conjugate versus direct addition, and that we get kinetic versus thermodynamic products, and they really depend upon what the conditions are of the reaction. So conditions become a big determining factor in what our major product is in those. So we need to pay attention to those things. Okay, I don't have enough time to go where I want to go next, but I'm just going to like preview it really quick and just give you an idea of the reaction that's coming up, because I sort of want to set the stage that this is the Diels-Alder reaction that I want to deal with next. The Diels-Alder reaction is a reaction where you have something called a diene and something called a dienophile, and they react in a cyclic concerted mechanism so that bond making and bond breaking happens simultaneously. And what we get are six-membered ring systems. And they're a way of making six-membered ring systems, which is super cool. But it gets even better than this, because what you can do is you can put substituents on these guys, A, B, and let's do C and D and E and F and G and H. And what winds up, oh, and Z out here. And what winds up happening is that's where Z goes. The E and F wind up out here. A and B wind up out here. C and D and G and H. Okay, so how many stereocenters does this create? When you look at how many stereogenic centers does it create? Four stereogenic centers. You remember how many isomers can be created from four stereogenic centers? It's 2 to the n, where n is the number of stereogenic centers. So 16. two to the four.
Oh, 16.
16 different molecules. This represents 16 different molecules. This reaction is both stereospecific and regiospecific, and can be made enantiospecific. So it is stereospecific, it's regiospecific, what these two imply is that out of 16 isomers, you can make a set of enantiomers, you can make just two molecules, a pair of enantiomers. But it can also be made to be enantiospecific. Which means that you can set all four of those stereocenters in one reaction. And for the longest time, it was the world record holder in the number of stereocenters that were set in a single reaction that could be controlled specifically. So we need to sort of really dig into this to understand why is this thing regiospecific and stereospecific, and how does the reaction actually work? And it takes a lot of molecular orbital theory and digging into it and looking at the orbitals and a lot of explaining in terms of how the Diels-Alder reaction actually works so that we can take and we can predict which way is this reaction going to go. And it does some really cool things, like you can take and make bicyclic ring systems out of this, because you can take things like this, five-membered ring systems, and react them with a dienophile. And when they react, they make bicyclic ring systems, and you can start making some really cool types of structures as these types of things come together. So lots of cool stuff to talk about in the Diels-Alder reactions. And then Diels-Alder leads us into paracyclic reactions, which also has a lot of molecular orbital theory that's in it. And it's all, these are all a lot of really fun reactions to look at. There's just a lot of stuff that we've already sort of done, but hadn't really thought about much. And so we'll see new ways to be able to use molecular orbital theory to understand these Diels-Alder reactions and how to control them. So lots of fun stuff coming up. All right, that's it for today. You know where I'm going next week. I'm happy to stay on the line to address any questions. And other than that, I'm gonna kill the recording and I'll see the afternoon lab at 3:00. Okay.